Welcome to NeuroSavvy.
Glad to be here.
Today we're exploring something a lot of people with multiple sclerosis are really curious about. Diet.
Absolutely. How it might fit into managing their health, you know?
Exactly. And we're going to focus specifically on two popular approaches. You've probably heard of them. The Swank diet and the Walls diet.
Mm-hmm. Two very different plans.
Right. And we want to look at what happens to, like, the essential nutrients, vitamins, minerals, when people with MS actually follow these diets.
Yeah, the big question is, how do these specific diets really impact what you're getting nutritionally?
And what could those changes mean? For symptoms, for overall health, that's what we're digging into.
It's such an important area because MS is, well, it's a complex chronic autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
And we have to be super clear up front. Diet is not a cure. No question about that.
Definitely not a cure.
But that said, a lot of individuals with MS experiment with dietary changes. They're trying things to manage symptoms.
Often on their own, right? Yeah. Without much guidance.
That's often the case, yeah. And that's where it gets tricky because you might make these big shifts without really understanding the full nutritional picture.
The consequences.
Exactly. And it really matters because we know that getting too little of certain nutrients or even potentially too much can influence things.
Like what?
Well, things like fatigue levels, maybe the number of brain lesions you see on an MRI, and just that general inflammation that goes along with MS.
Okay, so it's not just about feeling better anecdotally. Mm-hmm. There's real science about how nutrients might play a role.
Precisely. So this investigation really tried to measure that directly.
How do they do it?
They took people with relapsing remitting MS, had them follow either the Swank or the Walls diet, and tracked their nutrient intake really carefully.
Before and after.
Yep, before they started, and then again after about 12 weeks. And they also looked at the different supplements made.
Okay, let's break down the diets first. What's the Swank diet all about?
Right, so Swank, this one's been around a while, since the 1950s, actually.
Oh, okay.
Its main thing, its core principle, is being really low in saturated fat. Like, the goal is 15 grams a day or less.
15 grams, that's quite low.
It is. But otherwise, it allows a pretty wide range of foods. Whole grains, fruits, vegetables, lean proteins.
What about dairy and eggs?
Low-fat dairy is okay. Eggs are okay. Legumes, too. So the main restriction is really hammering down that saturated fat.
Okay, so focused, but maybe less restrictive overall than some others. How does Walls compare?
Walls is quite different. It's often described as a modified Paleolithic elimination diet.
Elimination is the key word there, I guess.
Absolutely. It cuts out several major food groups completely. No grains, no legumes, no dairy, no eggs, and even no nightshade vegetables for some versions.
Whoa. So what do you eat?
The focus shifts massively towards micronutrient density. The goal is pushing for a really high intake of vegetables and fruits. We're talking 6 to 9 cups a day.
6 to 9 cups. That's a lot of veggies.
It is, across different color groups. Plus, it emphasizes things like organ meats, nuts, and seeds.
Yeah.
The whole idea is maxing out nutrients from those allowed whole foods.
Okay.
And this is really important for this study. The participants who followed the Walls diet were also given a specific set of supplements.
Ah, okay. What kind of supplements?
Things like vitamin D, B12, folate, a general multivitamin, and cod liver oil.
Mm. That definitely sounds like it could influence the results. We'll come back to that. But first, how did they actually track what people ate? Just ask them.
No, they used a pretty rigorous method, a 3-day weighed food record.
Weighed, like with a scale.
Exactly. Participants had to weigh and record everything they ate and drank for 3 separate days.
Wow, that takes commitment.
It does. They did this at the start, you know, baseline, and then again after the 12 weeks on their assigned diet. Then the researchers analyze all that data using nutrient databases.
To see how intake changed compared to recommendations.
Right. Looking at adequacy, potential deficiencies, and also the specific effect of those supplements in the Walls group.
Okay, so after all that weighing and tracking, what did they find? Were there any improvements in nutrient intake?
Yes, definitely. Some clear positives. And what was interesting was that both diets, Swank and Walls, helped reduce the number of people who weren't getting enough of certain key vitamins.
Both of them. Which vitamins?
Particularly vitamins C, D, and E. So it seems like just adopting either one of these structured plans helped people hit the targets for those specific nutrients better than they were before.
That's good news. Both helped with C, D, and E. Did one seem better in other ways?
Well, the Walls diet, probably because of that intense focus on nutrient-dense plants and including things like organ meats, did show some extra improvements.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Specifically, people on the Walls diet got more magnesium and vitamin A from their food compared to before.
Okay, so that strategy of packing in nutrient-dense foods worked for those specific nutrients.
It seemed to, yeah. It highlights that the diet can successfully boost certain things within its allowed foods.
But I feel like there's a but coming. You mentioned Walls eliminates a lot of food groups. Did that cause any problems, any downsides?
And this is where it gets really crucial. Yes. The study found that the Walls diet, while boosting those few nutrients, also significantly increased the risk of people not getting enough of three other important ones.
Increase the risk of deficiency. Which ones?
Calcium, thiamine, that's vitamin B1 and vitamin B12.
Wait a second. A diet designed to be super nutrient dense actually made people more likely to be deficient in calcium B1 and B12. How does that work?
See, it sounds counterintuitive, right? But it comes right back to that elimination aspect.
Because it cuts out food sources.
Exactly. Think about it. Dairy is a major source of calcium for many people, and also B12 sometimes. Grains are often fortified with thiamine and other B vitamins.
Oh, okay.
So when you completely remove those entire food groups, you create these potential gaps. Even if you're eating tons of vegetables and other healthy things, it can be really hard to make up for those specific nutrients without their main sources.
So you might fix one thing but break another, nutritionally speaking.
That's a good way to put it. It shows the potential unintended pitfalls of very restrictive diets if they aren't super carefully planned or supplemented.
Right. Now, you mentioned the supplements the Walls group got in this study. Did those help with these deficiencies?
They did. And this is a critical piece of the puzzle. The supplementation did substantially reduce most of those deficiencies that popped up just from the food changes alone.
So the pills filled the gaps?
Largely, yes. They helped bridge the divide for things like vitamin D, E, magnesium, which makes sense given what they were supplemented with.
Okay, so supplements fix the problem the diet created.
Well, mostly. But, and it's a significant five, but the supplements introduced a different kind of risk.
What kind of risk?
The risk of getting too much. The study found that supplementation significantly increased the number of participants consuming potentially excessive amounts of certain nutrients.
Excessive, like more than is recommended, potentially harmful levels.
Exactly. They saw more people going over the recommended upper safe limits for vitamin D, niacin, that's vitamin B3, and magnesium.
Hmm. So even helpful supplements can be overdone.
Precisely. And interestingly, the issue with excessive magnesium was actually more common in the Swank group in this particular study.
Really? Even though Walls emphasizes magnesium-rich foods more?
Yeah, which suggests it might have been driven by general supplement use that's common among people with MS anyway, not necessarily just the diet itself. It just highlights that supplements need careful consideration, too. They aren't risk-free.
Okay, wow. So this is complex. Let's recap. Both diets help boost levels of vitamin C, D, E.
Right.
Walls boosted magnesium and vitamin A from food, but also created significant risks for calcium, B1, and B12 deficiency because it cuts out key food groups.
Correct.
And supplements help fill those Walls diet gaps, but they also push some people into potentially excessive intake of vitamin D, niacin, magnesium.
You've got it. That's the picture.
So what does all this mean for you, the listener, managing MS and trying to figure out food? Why should you care about these findings?
Okay, this is the really practical part. First, it kind of confirms something we already suspected. Micronutrient deficiencies aren't that unusual in people with MS to start with.
So you might already be low on some things before you even change your diet.
It's possible, yes. So that's the baseline. Second, it really underscores why these specific nutrients matter.
Right.
The research links nutrients like magnesium, folate, vitamins A, C, D, E to things that directly impact quality of life for someone with MS.
Like fatigue?
Exactly. Reduced fatigue, potentially better quality of life scores, maybe even less inflammation or fewer new spots on an MRI. Getting enough of these nutrients seems important.
So hitting those targets could actually make a difference in how you feel or how the disease progresses.
That's the connection researchers are exploring, absolutely. And that leads us to the biggest takeaway message here, I think,
which is
that while restrictive diets like Walls aim for health, often by removing things thought to be harmful, that very act of elimination can create new, sometimes hidden, nutrient gaps.
Like the calcium, B12, thiamine risk with Walls.
Precisely. You might be focusing on eating clean or avoiding certain foods, but accidentally become deficient in something else crucial without realizing it.
Trading one problem for another.
Potentially, yes. And then on the other side of the coin, if you rely heavily on supplements to fill those gaps,
you risk getting too much, like the vitamin D, niacin, magnesium issue here.
Exactly. It becomes this really delicate balancing act.
Okay. This really makes the case for needing personalized advice, doesn't it? Not just picking a diet off the shelf.
Absolutely. That's the clearest action point from this. Diet can be powerful. It can matter in MS management. But just grabbing a popular restrictive plan and going for it without professional input, well, it carries risks.
So what should you do if you have MS and are thinking about diet?
The strongest advice, based on this kind of evidence, is talk to a professional before making big changes. Consult your neurologist, or even better, a registered dietitian.
Someone who knows MS and nutrition.
Ideally, yes. Someone who can look at your specific situation, your current intake, and help you navigate a plan safely.
And what if you're already on, say, the Walls diet?
Then this study suggests being particularly mindful about calcium, vitamin B12, and thiamine. Talk to your doctor or dietitian. Do you need testing? Do you need targeted supplementation? Those are important conversations to have.
And pay attention to supplements you're already taking.
Definitely. This is a good reminder that more isn't always better. If you're taking supplements, especially high doses of things like vitamin D, niacin, or magnesium, discuss it with your provider. Maybe monitoring levels is a good idea to avoid overdoing it.
What about family or caregivers? How can they help?
Oh, they can be huge allies. Mm. Helping track what's actually being eaten, including supplements that information is golden for healthcare providers.
Like keeping a food diary.
Yeah, or just helping keep tabs. And encouraging or helping set up those consultations with a dietitian, especially when dietary changes are happening, that's incredibly supportive.
And for any clinicians listening in, what's the takeaway for practice?
I think it reinforces that we need to move beyond just saying, try the X diet. Personalized planning is key for restrictive regimens. And maybe thinking about routine monitoring for certain nutrients, vitamin D, calcium, magnesium, maybe B vitamins for patients on these kinds of diets could help catch issues early.
So wrapping it all up.
Yeah.
It seems these diets can help improve some nutrient levels, especially with supplements.
Yes, there were positives.
But the big caution is that restrictive diets have trade-offs. They can create new deficiencies even while trying to promote health.
That's the crucial balance. Nutritional adequacy isn't automatic just because a diet sounds healthy or cuts things out. It takes careful, informed planning.
It really drives home that dietary changes are serious tools. They need respect and ideally expert guidance.
Absolutely. Evidence-based personalization. That seems to be the key takeaway here. Understanding the specific impacts, good and bad, lets you use diet effectively.
Thinking about how easily you could slip into deficiency or excess. It really makes you consider nutrient balance differently, doesn't it? Especially with a chronic condition. Something to mull over.
Definitely food for thought.
Feed your mind, challenge your thinking, and we'll reconnect next time on NeuroSavvy.